Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, a show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on this week's programme, identity.
There are much less official reasons than heraldry why the Torinese cherish their Tourette. These reasons have to do with affection and the positivity these small cast iron columns inspire.
What is that feeling, that sense that distinguishes one city from another? Be it culturally, through innovation, government policies, or more tangible approaches, there are certain quirks that immediately define a city or a region. And, as we've been seeing recently, being sure of who or what you are doesn't always please everyone.
While history, culture, and politics all feed the nationalist fervour, the question remains, why do so many Catalans cling to their regional identity but are so willing to jettison the nationality that is still written in their passports?
From urban features to planning, cultural institutions and professions, join us over the next 30 minutes as we examine what makes up a place. That's all coming up right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck, on Monocle 24. Well, we start this week's programme in Catalonia. The region's struggle with self-determination is almost as old as the area itself, and it all came to a head early this month when a vote was held on independence. The central government in Madrid called the vote illegal, and independent supporters were treated as insurgents. The violence that ensued made headlines and front pages all over the world, and everyone got involved, from King Felipe to the owners of Barcelona's football team. Well, our correspondent in the region takes a look now at Catalonia and how regional identity compares with the national one. And here he is.
Spain has an identity crisis. Whether you're an angry Catalan independence activist marching through the streets of Barcelona, one of the many madrileños who are suddenly fixing a Spanish flag to their balcony in recent weeks, or part of the countless confused caught in the middle of these two strains of simplified nationalism, it seems as if the entire country is being forced to reflect on who they are. But who are they? Who are we? And who decides? More pointedly, why does someone living in Barcelona feel so different from a person residing in Madrid? Recently, during a visit to the Catalan city of Girona, a short exchange I had with a lovely young woman behind the counter of the tourism office seemed to capture the country's inner conundrum. After pointing out some eateries in the Plaza de la Independencia, she passionately explained how Catalonia had been independent 300 years ago, and that me and my rather incredulous mother should join with the Catalan people in their quest to reclaim their sovereignty. It was a strange moment. Here was a girl invoking a historical moment from distant memories centuries before her grandmother had even been born to ask two strangers to help her and other like-minded secessionists in a quest that really had nothing to do with us. What made her think that this was at all appropriate in the tourism office can probably be traced to her proud, passionate Catalan identity, which now, more than ever, has been framed around a fight for survival against an oppressive ogre that they call the authoritarian Spanish state. One's identity has a tendency to inform how we act, what we believe, and especially what we say. This one girl's willingness to share her proud Catalan identity is readily displayed all around the region. The countless Catalan estelada flags of rebellion that are brandished on so many balconies make this clear. But while history, culture, and politics all feed the nationalist fervour, the question remains, why do so many Catalans cling to their regional identity but are so willing to jettison the nationality that is still written in their passports? At the risk of falling into the same trap of simplified dichotomies that make nationalism so enticing to some, Spain's current identity crisis is being fueled by two principal factors. The first is a well-organized, romanticized, and attractive vision for the future with catchy slogans, overly ambitious economic projections, hints of superiority, and allusions to a new Mediterranean Arcadia called the Catalan Republic. The discourse, which is reminiscent of the Brexit campaign's Take Back Control sloganeering, paints a David and Goliath battle of an oppressed nation whose potential is being stifled by a backward behemoth called the Spanish state. The second precedes the first, and like many of Spain's contemporary ales, has its roots in the recent financial and institutional crisis. In the darkest days of economic and social turmoil that have troubled the country for the past decade, Spain's national spirit took a battering. With Mariano Rajoy at the helm, undoubtedly Spain's most reticent, slow-acting prime minister, the lack of reassuring words, of a national narrative, or a plan for the future created a vacuum, and the silence was deafening. Yet in Barcelona, some Catalan politicians, many of whom were themselves tainted by the policies of austerity and the scourge of corruption, sniffed an opportunity. The vacuum left by Rajoy on the national level was filled with a promising new future at a regional level. With not much left to lose and convinced by their local leaders that they had everything to gain, many Catalans signed up to the promising path to secession. The past was selectively used to explain the present and to justify a more alluring future.
Españoles, Franco ha muerto.
Since the death of Franco, and perhaps even because of him, most Spanish leaders have shied away from any talk of national unity. The country hasn't even been able to agree on lyrics to a national anthem, which means Spanish Olympians are usually left to hum their country's melody while standing proudly on the gold medal podium. Today, in stark contrast to that young woman working behind the tourist desks of Girona, someone in Madrid might find it much more difficult to articulate what makes them so uniquely Spanish. Although they'll probably be able to quickly list off what makes them a madrileño. This is as much a failure of the political leadership as it is one of national storytelling. For example, conservative leaders have been unwilling to embrace the country's diversity as a strength rather than a threat. And while the country has a plethora of achievements to be proud of in its 40-year democratic history, it still struggles to make room for everyone at its rowdy family table, which includes the Basques, the Andalusians, Canary Islanders, and Galicians, to name just a few. Today, we live in a world where the tussle between local and global identities is confusing, emotional, and constant. The way in which this tussle has quickly turned to turmoil in Spain should be cause for concern, especially as some politicians seem so quick to perpetuate divisive us-versus-them rhetoric from the comfort of their lecterns.
Gracias. Buenos días, señor presidente.
People will happily unite around a common idea or purpose because grand movements have a tendency to provoke euphoria, much like the endorphins that musicians enjoy as they perform in an orchestra. But as an increasing number of Barceloneses, Catalans, Spaniards, and Europeans beat their chests with one hand and point their fingers with the other, they might want to stop and ask themselves, why does one of these identities need to come at the expense of all the rest? For Monocle in Barcelona, I'm Liam Aldous.
Next, we cross the border into France and head onwards to neighbouring Italy. Many cities take their biggest, boldest monument as a symbol, but for the famously modest Turinese, municipal identity comes by way of a much smaller and humbler element of the urban landscape. City pride flows in the city's public drinking fountains, the Turret. Monocle's Chiara Rimella explains to us why her city's omnipresent green, bull-shaped fountains make for such a refreshing city emblem.
Rome has the Colosseum, Pisa has the Leaning Tower, Milan has the Duomo, and Turin? Well, it would be easy to say the symbol of this city in northern Italy is the Mole Antonelliana, the pointy tower which has even made its way on the back of the nation's 2-cent euro coins. But for the Turinese, thinking of their city's identity brings to mind another, much humbler urban element. The Tourette, that's the nickname us Turinese give it, is a street-side public fountain made of cast iron, painted in bottle green. Its most notable attribute is the fact it has a bull's head for a spout, hence its name. In Italian, bull translates as toro, the rampant animal features on the city's coat of arms, a bright yellow shape against a blue background. But there are much less official reasons than heraldry why the Turinese cherish their Tourette. These reasons have to do with affection and the positivity these small cast iron columns inspire. There are 813 Tourettes spread across the city, all the way from the historic centre to the suburbs. When they first made their appearance in the 1860s, the Tourettes were brought to the market squares, to parks and tree-lined avenues. They provided refreshment for those who'd been out on a passeggiata and plenty of water to clear up the pavements after the vegetable stands had wrapped up for the day. It was in the 1930s, however, that they became as widespread across the city as they are now. There is hardly a piazza across Turin that is devoid of its faithful, bright Tourette. Part of the success of the Tourette is due to its design. At around 1 meter tall, each small cast iron column is just the right height for both children, sweaty from an excited football game, and older gentlemen with a sore back, unwilling to bend too far. Inside its bottom pedestal, there's even a small bowl that provides for the pooches. But the key to a Tourette's democratic appeal lies in the water. For one, a crystal clear stream flows incessantly from it, making a Tourette always inviting, welcoming, and apparently unable to ever dry up. And then there's the quality of said water. Back in the days, it used to come straight from the spring of the Pian della Mussa, up at 1815 meters in the Alps. Later, a very legitimate concern for the waste of resources led City Hall to link the Tourette to the city's aqueducts. Nowadays, coming out of the bull's mouths is a mixture of spring water and purified water from the city's river, the Po. But whenever you take a bow to gulp a mouthful, a Tourette's water feels just as cool and delicious as it did in all childhood memories. There's a reason why former mayor Valentino Castellani celebrated winning the municipal elections by drinking on a Tourette. To evoke an image of refreshing civic pride and its power to serve the public with verve. It was a canny move. The Turinese loved their Tourette. So much so that attempts by the local government to repaint some of these bull fountains another colour than their original green, or even, heaven forbid, to replace some of them with more stylized stone structures, were met with absolute dismay and caused genuine uproar. The city may have stopped commissioning the foundry which used to make all Tourette, so no new ones are in the works, yet the Turinese won't let go of their beloved symbol. You mess with their bulls, and you're inevitably going to get the horns. For Monocle, I am Chiara Rimella.
You're listening to The Urbanist on Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Tuck, and this is our episode all about identity. Istanbul is a city of many layers, and the way its neighbourhoods are organised is a reflection of the cultural influences of the many empires that have once ruled this great city. But one aspect in particular shows how having a strong local identity can work to your advantage. Some neighbourhoods are still organised by craft and by what they sell, meaning that the old Byzantine way of planning a city still works many centuries later. Our features editor, Chris Lord, told Carlotta Rabello all about this.
The Byzantines did used to organise their districts. Of course, the Byzantines were there in Constantinople, as Istanbul used to be known, before the Turks invaded, and it was then a kind of Greek civilization that became, obviously, Ottoman Turkish Muslims. But one thing that has remained all through that is this idea that you have certain districts that are organised according to what they sell and what they make there. Istanbul is an interesting place because it's still a place where things are made in the city centre. So you don't really see that very often in cities very much these days, certainly not in European cities, where the centre of the town, you will still find workshop, you can hear people welding. You can hear people hammering things and building things. And the reason that you can still find that is because you do still have these areas which are quite often built around one single object that you can buy. So I did used to report a lot from Istanbul. And in fact, we had a bureau there and I used to run our bureau in Istanbul for Monocle. And where we were located in an area called Karaköy, if you go just sort of down towards the Bosphorus or towards the Golden Horn, I should say, there is a whole area there that for time and time and time has been the hardware area. So you go there, you can find hammers, you can find this, you can find that. But you can also find a little bit earlier in time when it used to be the place where the metal workers were. So you can still buy the hammam taps there. You can still buy all these things for your home that are used day to day. And then that traditionally was the way that they built these cities, that you had an entire district dedicated to a certain craft. If you go down the Golden Horn just a little bit more, you end up in a place called Eyüp, as it's spelled in Turkish. And that used to be traditionally the toy makers district. And that was the whole area there was for toy makers. You go a little bit down the Golden Horn and there's a whole area called Haskoy. And that was where you would buy wool and cotton and things like that and textiles. So it's an old tradition of having one single thing that you know if you go there, you're going to find vendors who sell all this stuff. And you're also going to find craftsmen who make those things and work raw materials into those objects.
It's quite astonishing to think that that has survived, because Istanbul is a city that, you know, made of so many layers, has so many different influences through its history. And somehow that kind of planning, looking ahead to the future in a way, managed to survive.
I think you're right. I think what's really surprising is how these guys stay in business. That was the one thing I could never understand. It was like you go up the road from where our bureau used to be in Karaköy. There is a whole area dedicated to light shops. So the whole area is like lit up in the middle of the day with neon lights and LED lights and all these things. The whole set, it must be about four or five streets. Now, initially, I couldn't quite understand. It's like, if you're one business there, why on earth would you want to move next to all your competition? But the reality is that for a lot of people, I think, in Istanbul, they develop such a relationship with those stockists and these people who buy and sell these things that it doesn't really matter that you're kind of all together, really. Like, it means that you sort of, everybody has their own customers almost.
And I'm so going to say, you stick to a shop and you just go there.
You stick to a shop. It's not a case of kind of browsing around and finding the best deal. It's a case of you go to one person and they sell you the thing. And I wonder if, you know, I do wonder if that comes from an old tradition. I mean, this is not based in any fact, or this is just speculation, but an old tradition that you still find there of the Han. And the Han was a, they're still there, but they're sort of these three-story buildings. And on the ground floor, they were traditionally the places where traders would put their pack animals, so maybe a camel or mules and so on. So they would have a kind of stables area at the bottom. And then on each level up, you would have craftsmen on the top level, and then you would have vendors on the first level, and you would have all this organization. And the reason that it was designed in that way was so that the traders could come in, they could sell what they had to sell, they could buy what they wanted to buy direct from the craftsmen themselves, and it was all in one place. And so I think, as well as that idea of sort of, you know, you build your own clientele and the clientele keep coming back, I think this sort of almost like container battery mentality towards how you arrange your shopping district, I think it comes back to that Han thinking where we need everything in one place because that makes things much easier.
You're talking about the crafts in these neighborhoods, and they're all quite, you know, old crafts. Is that also the case for the newest crafts? Do we also see designers and the architects taking over different districts? Or is it back to, you know, making things actually with your hands that have been done that way for centuries?
That's a really good question. I mean, if we think of actually, maybe if we can say it's not really a craft per se, but I mean, if we think of the galleries, I don't think anyone would say that there was a gallery district in Istanbul, for instance. I think Turks are very good at making neighborhoods trendy for a little while, and it really does happen. And I remember when Karaköy, where we were, became very trendy, and suddenly, you know, everybody was opening shops there, everybody was opening cafes there, and with the same speed and passion and recklessness in some cases, they pulled out as well and moved to another new fancy district that everyone wanted to be. The reality is, you know, it's so old, that place, that You know, if you're going to try and build a little district where it's all designers all there and stuff, it's pretty hard because there's lots of people who've been there for many, many years who won't leave because that is their family place and they, rightly so, don't want to give it up. And so therefore the idea of sort of cramming everybody together. But you do find a few areas where you'll find a certain, for want of a better phrase, a tone of the kind of businesses that you'll find, maybe young people running barbershops, young people running great cafes that all have a certain shared aesthetic between them. But in terms of sort of contemporary craft, actually, this is probably a good thing, I guess. The people who do work in what we would term craft, you know, those people who sell now maybe beautifully designed knives or beautifully designed stemware or maybe are making tables or chairs or whatever, quite often it won't be the designers themselves who are making it. In fact, they will work with those old guys who've been making this stuff for years and years, a little bit behind the scenes almost. They will work with them to produce their work, and obviously it will be much more an expensive price than it would typically be to buy these guys' things because you've got this design element that then comes into it from somebody else. But I think there is a sort of interesting moment there where younger people are starting to tap into the crafts that have been there for a long time and see ways that if we rebranded this slightly or brought a little bit more design thinking into it, everyone can make a lot more money and these crafts are not going to die out. But I think, unfortunately, the Han as a concept, I mean, it stays a number.
We started this conversation talking about how the planning defined the city, the fact that you go to different districts and you know exactly what you're going for. But now it seems that also part of Istanbul's identity is the fact that it's a crafts capital. People still make things in the city. Today you see capitals around the world that try, and major cities around the world that try to, you know, import this idea of a fabrication lab, a fab lab. Mm. Let's bring makers back to the city. And it seems that Istanbul, they just never left.
Well, that's very true. And in fact, that was one of the things that I loved about living in that city, was that you walked out in the middle of the day and there were people who worked with their hands all over the city. And it is changing, unfortunately, because of the nature of gentrification means that a lot of these old neighborhoods are very rapidly becoming partly influenced by tourism, but also by real estate as well. And the government of Turkey has tried to kind of make sure that these guys obviously don't go out of business, and they kind of move them into these sort of craft malls that have been opening up around town. And they're never quite right. They never quite got the essence of it. And I think the reason that they don't get the essence of it, I have been to some of these as well. There's a few nice examples of it that were built in the 60s that were quite successful. But I think in a more modern sense, what makes these making areas good, it is the life of the neighborhood that they have, the identity around them. And as much as there's these amazing rituals to Turkish life and Turkish street life that I think do create amazing identity. I mean, really simple things like the guy who comes around in the morning with tea on a tray that he carries around through the streets. Everybody knows he's going to be there. That kind of thing creates this sort of sense of community in amongst all these businesses. And so when they stick them all in a mall where there's no kofta shop down the road and no, you know, little meyhane selling rakı for the end of the day, I think you kind of lose some of that texture of it not just being a place to work. It's a place you live and work. Even if your house is far away, you go there and you are socializing in a neighborhood way, even when you're at work. You've got to remember the city is one of the oldest cities in the world, and it's been inhabited for so, so long. And it's vast, you know. I mean, by some estimates, 17 million people live in Istanbul, by some of the estimates today, and it's getting bigger all the time. Yet, if you go and live there for some time, what you immediately start to find is that it's actually a bunch of villages all put together into a metropolis. And that goes all the way down to, I think, where I used to live. At the end of our street was a guy who came out every single morning to feed the stray cats who gathered in the neighborhood. He wasn't alone in the city. There were guys like him in every single neighborhood, or mahalle, as they call them in Turkish. Every single one had a guy who was there to feed the stray cats, because without him, something would be missing. You know, even look at the names of these areas. Karaköy, it means black village. Köy means village. And that's why you have that word so common in the names of Turkish places and neighborhoods around Istanbul, because it is a collection of villages.
That was Monocle's features editor, Christopher Lord, and he was in conversation with our very own Carlotta Rebello. Now, what we've been discovering, obviously, over the past 20 minutes is that a city or a region's identity is made up of a great number of elements, from ideas and values to more tangible features. And in the case of Vienna, it's all about the city's typical professions. And with that in mind, Monocle's Alexey Korolyov talks about one of the city's stalwarts, the Viennese waiter.
Der Wiener sitzt oft ganz allein in sein Café.
Vienna is many things. It is the ubiquitous Baroque, the relaxed Catholicism, the bloated civil service, the mouthy proletariat, the remnants of the bourgeoisie. And it all comes together in one place, in that fine institution without which the city would be simply unimaginable, the Viennese Coffee House. And the coffee house, in turn, is inconceivable without the Viennese waiter.
The spirit of the coffee house, if you feel it and love it, you can do it your whole life.
Milan Matosic is one of that rare breed of human being. A Hungarian by birth, he has been a waiter all his life, first at Café Weimar in the Weringerstrasse, and now at Café Sperl in the Gumpendorfer Straße.
You're right.
With his bushy moustache and his flattering yet patronising manner, he's the living embodiment of Vienna's traditions of hospitality and internationalism.
You can learn how to use your mind. You can learn how to serve a plate or just a coffee cup, but you can't learn to be a waiter. You must be a waiter. You feel it, you love it, you live it.
But, you know, many people say, and I have noticed that as well, that Viennese waiters, especially in coffee houses like this one, are quite rude and arrogant. You know, is that also part of the...
The part of the charm, the arrogance, it comes just from the living culture in Vienna. We have 23 districts in Vienna, and every district is a small part world for himself. Everyone takes his culture outside and give it to every coffee shop, the speciality in every district. And the specials of the coffee shops are the waiters, the old waiters. They're working 20, 30, 40 years, whole life in one coffee, like this here in Sperl. And it belongs.
Dieses Bild des Wiener Ober, des Wiener Kellner, ist vielleicht traditionell aus der Vergangenheit ein bisschen mitgebracht worden.
Doris Litschauer at the Austrian Public Employment Service says coffeehouse waiters are an important part of Vienna's historic image, but it isn't like they're specifically looking for people like Milan.
No, it's not like that. But of course you should be a good host and make a good impression on the tourists. You should also have that specific type of humour that the Viennese bring into any work they do.
There is, however, a clear age divide when it comes to working in a coffee house.
Younger people strive to go into event catering or discotheques. They want to roller skate through the restaurant. Younger people don't want to spend their whole life in an old Viennese coffee house.
Just as the waiters must be a certain age, so too must the coffee houses themselves. Milan Matosic says he had to leave Café Weimar after a new owner started modernizing the property.
I lived for 30 years in the 9th district, at a corner from the Café Weimar. There was personal reasons I have to leave there because it's an overtake under other owner, and I know for years the coffee spell, I'd like it very much, and I like the spirit inside, because if you lose the spirit, I don't see any reason to stay there more longer, to give my part of the spirit to inside, and we have to leave, because the other owner has changed everything. Now it's the same name, Weimar, but the spirit is gone. I am so sorry, it's a big pity, because I thought I'm going to stay there until the end, till my 65 years, and to say thank you and goodbye, so long. But we have to leave, all of us, there. It's the same entry, you know, inside, infrastructure in the name. There is no spirit anymore inside. You can feel it, you know. You go inside, everything's so cold, so ooh.
Milan chose a good place to retire. Café Sperl shows no sign of change. But just in case, come visit him while the spirit is still there. For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolov.
Erst waren sie alle vier sehr glücklich, doch dann kam die Mischkulanz. Dort wird der Gustl die Marie küsst, sicht die Resel und der Franz.
Well, that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Carlotta Rebello and was edited by David Stevens. Tune in on Monday when a brand new edition of Tall Stories comes out. And also remember to subscribe to ensure that you don't miss out on any new episodes. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, however, here's Malvina Reynolds with Little Boxes. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes on